You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 20th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. We have a double this day in history. 1975, Viking program. NASA launches Viking 1 towards Mars. And in 1977, the Voyager program. NASA launches Voyager 2 spacecraft.
Voyager.
The one with the disc on it with all the pictures and the music and the sounds of the Earth and so forth.
The Chuck Berry.
Yeah. Yep.
Send more Beatles. Chuck Berry.
That's the one that has like the size chart of how big a human would be standing next to the actual spacecraft.
Right. The man and the woman naked, and didn't Sagan have a hand in that?
Yes.
There's also, did you guys know they put a little monkey inside the spacecraft?
Oh, what was its name?
His name was Stabby.
Stabby?
Good thing they gave him a knife to carry.
They were just trying to get rid of him because he was causing some trouble. So.
Oh, Stabby.
So we do have a sad anniversary today as well. So yesterday, August 19th, was the one-year anniversary of the passing of our fellow rogue and good friend, Perry DeAngelis. We wrote a blog on the Rogues Gallery today, all just sharing some of our quick thoughts about Perry and what he meant to us, and still how, a year later, obviously, we all still very much feel the loss of our good friend and miss his presence on this podcast.
I can't even listen to him. I don't want to listen to his voice.
You're not ready yet?
Just not there. I just don't want to listen.
Oh, you don't? I do. I occasionally call him up and listen to him. It's great.
Yeah, I love it. I love listening to him.
I find it therapeutic.
I'm not there yet.
I wrote in the blog today, it's been a year, and the real hard pain is definitely over. And I was trying to write something positive. I couldn't write anything positive. There's nothing positive in any way. I could say, he's in my heart and all that stuff or whatever, but it just boils down to it's a loss. And death doesn't make any sense to me, and I miss him terribly. And that's it. That's part of life. That's one of the things that's built into life. And
yeah,
I don't think Perry would have wanted us to candy coat and fluff up his memory anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, but I agree with you. I mean, it's just no way around the fact that it's a net loss. It's a loss. You know, that more than anything, I really would love to have a conversation with Perry. He was so fun to talk to about anything, about the news. I mean, he would be so into the election this year.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Oh, he'd be having
everything that's happened with
day.
The show over the last year, all the crazy things in the news. And I would love to have a conversation with him about that, but it can't happen.
If something was crazy, if something was nonsense, if he was totally against something, didn't matter who it was when it came to politics, he'd let you know about it strongly.
He consumed hours of political news every day. He really was a political junkie.
Well, he'd watch TV on the can, right?
he would, and he would call me from watching TV on the can to tell me about the latest breaking news that he saw on CNN or Fox or something. He called me once or twice a day to give me news updates. I mean, he just had to talk to somebody about it. Certainly a big, big aspect of him that's now gone in our lives. We don't have that now, so... It is a bit somber.
He's still very much missed. I do have a bit of pro-monkey news from today, just in honor of Perry. There was a news item about a monkey that eluded a vast dragnet in Tokyo. So somehow a wild Japanese monkey got into a Tokyo train station, and they had, they say, 30 policemen surrounding the monkey, trying to catch it with a variety of snares and nets, and the monkey eluded all of them, eluded the entire police force. He got away, and he was spotted heading towards a park. So they think he got away to this park. They said he was a Japanese monkey. I looked it up just curious as to what kind of monkey that was. I couldn't find a Japanese monkey, but it might have been a Japanese macaque. Is that the more specific name?
The Japanese don't have a good history of capturing runaway animals and other creatures in their cities.
God.
I mean, look at all those old movies, of that giant lizard, 50-foot lizard, crushing around their city.
Apparently, they're having a bit of a bit of a monkey overpopulation problem.
We have a distinct lack of monkeys in North America here.
Yes.
Wild.
We don't have many wild monkeys in North America. That's true. Well, speaking of North American monkeys, we have an update on the Bigfoot story from last week.
Thank you. Nice segue. Perfect.
So last week, these two guys from Georgia said they had, you know, they started BigfootTracker.com and they captured the collected the dead body of a Bigfoot, and they saw a family of big feet living in the forest. They were going to reveal it to the world, and they had scientists doing the DNA analysis. We recorded the show prior to their big press release on Friday, and we predicted, we went out on a limb and predicted that the press release was going to be a bust, that they weren't going to actually give us any new data. They weren't going to show the body. And I remember, Jay, you were saying, well, what's the end game here? What did these guys hope to accomplish? I mean, clearly that's a fake. So where's it all going to lead? Well, very, very quickly, more quickly than I anticipated, the hoax has been exposed. That was pretty fast. And it was a rubber costume. Their press release was a bust. Obviously, they didn't have any evidence to put forward. They just said about all the evidence they were going to be presenting, but they didn't have any actual evidence.
Well, the rumor on the internet is that they think that Biscardi paid $50,000.
Yeah, so one possibility is that the end game was that these two guys were just playing Biscardi, trying to get $50,000 or whatever they could out of him. And, you know, maybe the whole press release and everything kind of got out of control, but it could have just been a con against Biscardi.
Well, there's another possibility here, one that I would not overlook, is that Biscardi could be in on the whole thing.
Yeah.
Could be totally playing this, making all these claims just to continue to keep his name and his company, Searching for Bigfoot Incorporated, in the headlines.
But now Biscardi is claiming that the two guys vanished with his money, with his $50,000.
How long can you vanish with $50,000?
Oh my
grand?
God! I just fell for the old rubber Bigfoot scam. I can't believe it.
Yeah. They light a book of matches under his shoe too. I mean, what the hell?
You know, if the whole thing was a scam, if we go under that idea real quick, you know, they might have been gambling, saying, okay, how much money could we make through internet advertising and through selling things on the website and everything?
So Matthew Witten and Ricky Dyer are the two Georgian guys who did this, and Matthew Witten was a police officer.
Yeah.
And he, upon hearing that it was a hoax, Chief of Police Jeffrey Turner said that he filed the papers to terminate his employment. So he lost his job.
I didn't say that they were smart at making their plans.
Well,
but definitely, it's definitely possible. You know, they could have made a this is me just having fun with this. But, you know, they might have said, hey, with internet advertising and sales of hats and T-shirts and all that, you know, maybe we'll make $100,000. We'll split it three ways, and then we'll have our end game story. You know, this would be the story at the end.
We may have seen
well,
the end game.
Someone speculated that maybe these guys were starting off as more of a low-key hoax, and they sort of got out of control.
Yeah.
So and they didn't
out of control. Bigfoot
to.
Corpse.
That was Biscardi. That was him who put that whole press conference.
But it was
together.
Not Biscardi running the press conference, right? That was, I think, one of the guys. It was Witten. Yeah, yeah. And they made a YouTube video. It seemed all a little premeditated. I agree. I think that they kind of knew were doing it deliberately. But yeah, I think the end result of all this is that what will persist in the public consciousness is that there was another Bigfoot hoax.
I was flipping around television this weekend, Friday night, Saturday night. And so forth. Just happened to have some time in front of the television. Do you know how many Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, Abominable Snowman shows and documentaries and movies? And it was almost like it was Bigfoot weekend, some sort of celebration that I wasn't aware of, that they were celebrating Bigfoot.
Yeah, they were probably just capitalizing on this news story, you know, rerunning stock shows they have on anything related to Bigfoot. It's just mind candy for the masses.
Well, the good news about this whole thing is that at least Biscardi here has his Halloween costume all ready to go this year.
Yeah,
and the next year.
This really cracked me up. Right, and they're even advertising this fact on the website horrordome.com. It's a really good website for lots of different Halloween props. They've got quite a variety here. And of course, on the front page, it has a picture of Bigfoot. It goes, "Bigfoot, is it real? Has our costume been used in elaborate nationwide hoax?"
I wonder if these two Georgians are going to somehow be tied to this costume shop as all part of an elaborate advertising scheme in order to sell more Bigfoot costumes. See? That's reasonable, right?
It can salvage anything from this. Well, let's move on. The next news item is just an interesting science news item. Recently, researchers led by Kevin Warwick at the University of Reading have developed a robot that is run entirely by rat neurons. So what they did was they teased out neurons from a rat fetus. So they had individual neurons. Then they plated it out on an electrode matrix of like an array of 60 electrodes. And, you know, grew up the neurons. The neurons actually connected to each other, formed a little network. And they made essentially a little mini biological computer out of these rat neurons, and that interfaced with the robot through this array of electrodes. And they were able to actually teach this little mini rat brain, it's not really a rat brain, but this sort of matrix of rat neurons, some basic functionality. It was able to learn, and they were able, and they had sort of different modules that they could plug into, you know, different arrays of rat neurons they could plug into the robot. And they said over time they kind of developed different personalities. You know, some were more compliant and others were more quirky. So it's very extremely interesting. The whole brain-computer interface is one of those technologies that Kurzweil and others talk about as being critical to the whole singularity concept, this notion that scientific progress is going to proceed at, you know, an exponential rate and is going to alter not just our tools but ourselves. And it's interesting how it's being really approached from completely different angles. So we have some scientists trying to reverse engineer the brain. Others are trying to build artificially intelligent computers. There are some that are combining these approaches, that they're trying to model the brain with artificially intelligent computers or with computer technology. And, you know, meaning they're trying to test their models of how the brain works by simulating them in computers. And then those computers that are meant to simulate brain function actually turn out to function, you know, in a way very similar to the brain that it's modeling. So far, it seems like just modeling the brain with a computer creates a functioning computer program or hardware. Does that make sense? That's always that big question. If you actually just duplicated a human brain in silicon, would it be artificially intelligent? You know? The answer so far seems to be yes, although we won't know until we take that final step. But now this is yet another approach of actually trying to build a biological computer from the ground up using neurons as a basic building block for a computational matrix. And, you know, all of these technologies may ultimately merge.
It's going to be a great ride.
Well, I'm glad that they're starting to work on this particular type of research because it's kind of like a fuzzy line that needs to be drawn. Like, some people are uncomfortable about it, and I'm glad to hear that someone is finally starting to do it, because it really is one of the first steps that needs to be taken in order for significant advancement to happen here.
Yeah, I think they dodged a major controversial bullet by using rat neurons.
Oh,
imagine,
yeah.
I do this with human neurons.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
and at this level, I think they could have done it with human neurons.
I think at this level, it would have made absolutely no difference.
Right.
You know, it wouldn't have been any more of a human intelligence because it was with human neurons or with rat neurons. But just the idea of it would have sparked a huge controversy, in my opinion. So anyway, they used rat neurons. It really didn't matter. They accomplished their goal and sidestepped a lot of the controversy. Although the press was still using the term Franken-robot to refer the creature that the robot with the rat brain.
Yeah, it's an interesting approach, and I like how we're kind of approaching this whole idea from so many different angles.
Yeah, I think that these different approaches are all eventually going to merge, where we are interfacing biological brains with computers seamlessly. You know, and right now, if a part of your brain isn't working, we can kind of compensate for it, but there's no way we have no technology to replace the lost functionality. One approach to replace lost functionality would be stem cells to actually grow new neurons, and that's a very promising approach, although, you know, again, remains to be seen how far that will pan out. But another approach would be just to build a computer that does what the lost brain tissue should be doing and implant that in the brain. You can also, of course, think about doing that for augmentation. You know, imagine having a supercomputer interfaced with your brain. You know, you can have do calculations and have incredible vast storage of knowledge at your mental fingertips, as it were. It's not too hard to imagine these applications, you know, extrapolating from these kinds of technological developments that are happening now.
I think that's the way we're going to go. I think it's going to be augmentation, like you described, Steve, where you're actually inserting parts, not only replacing parts. I'd say your hippocampus, say you have a stroke, and not only replacing the hippocampus, but also at some point we'll be augmenting. And unfortunately, that's going to be a tough hurdle to cross because a lot of people have a problem with: are we healing you or are we augmenting you? And they don't want to cross that line to pure augmentation. They want to just make you, you know, normal again. But at some point, we got to cross that line when it'll be so easy and so beneficial to make these upgrades, if you will, that people will try. It's a very fuzzy line between
augmenting and treating a problem or a quote unquote disease. Here's an example from an existing technology. So there are some people who are extremely short. They're at the very short end of the spectrum. So they may have a specific medical condition which makes them short, or they may just be short and you can call what they have, whatever, they make less growth hormone or whatever. Is it really a disease or a disorder, or is that just the way they are genetically? In any case, you could take artificial human growth hormone, when you're young, to achieve more of a normal height. Are we augmenting, short people to make them taller? Are we treating shortness as a disorder or a disease? And how short do you have to be before you're treating something rather than trying to have an edge by being taller still? If someone's 5'6" and they want to be 6 feet tall, is that different than somebody who's 4'2" and they want to get closer to 5'2"? So it's extremely fuzzy. Let's take cognitive ability, just raw intelligence. At what point are you treating a cognitive disorder versus just augmenting normal human intelligence? That's an extremely fuzzy line. There'd be no way to make a sharp demarcation there. And then once some people are doing it, then everyone's going to want to do it in order to keep up, So those are the kind of issues that get raised with this technology. This is going to be perhaps more than many or most other technologies. The ethical controversies are just waiting to happen with this type of technology when we really start, having the ability to completely alter human intelligence,
Yeah, and for me, that the intelligence aspect of this augmentation is so much more compelling than the purely physical aspects, which are compelling themselves. It's very interesting to think of what we may be able to do once we have the technology to augment ourselves physically, but mentally, wow, that's just but also the ramifications and some of the things that we could potentially accomplish if we allow ourselves to do that, it could be pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, Bob, give us a quick report on in honor of the Olympics. Again, we're doing another Olympics related story. Wired magazine did a recent article on the future of doping. Tell us about that.
Yeah, very good article. Unfortunately, I haven't been following the Olympics as much as I would have liked, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of talk about doping as there were in previous Olympics. Regardless of that, still though, the IOC president estimates that there may be as many 40 positive doping violations this year. I'm not sure when he made that estimate, but most of them, and this was a surprise to me, most of them will be for steroids and EPO, which is a blood-boosting hormone. Steroids, I found surprising. I can't believe people are even still trying that, considering the sophistication of our detection techniques for something as simple as steroids. Maybe they have new ways to administer it, or I don't know. But still, they're expecting a bunch of people to be caught doing that. But I'm really curious about, though, is what's it going to be like for the next few Olympics? What are the kind of things that you're going to be hearing about in the news this time of year, say for the 2012 or 2016 Summer Olympics? Some of them might be a couple of the following things. One of them, which has really got me intrigued, is myostatin. Myostatin is a nasty little protein that blocks muscle growth. So inhibiting this protein in mice, if you can inhibit this protein, obviously, then muscle growth is more unrestrained, and they produce some pretty wicked results with mice. Some of them have produced more than 60% more lean muscle mass than the controls. They've also got a different technique now that has boosted it 116% for the male mice. This isn't just, oh, it works in mice but not people deals. So don't even go there, Steve. I've seen pictures of I saw a picture recently of a whippet that have this anomaly that you compare one to the other and they are just like the Arnold Schwarzenegger of dogs, and they're like much much faster than their normal counterparts. And I saw a picture of a kid who would naturally has a very low amount of myostatin in his system, and this kid, I mean, I only saw like his calf, but that's all I needed to see, because this toddler really had bigger calves than me. I mean, it was amazing. You could really see a huge chunk of muscle there. So but this points to a problem though, because any anti-doping testing that you have would need to distinguish between natural people like this kid and those that have been artificially augmented. So that's a very important thing. But also, obviously, medical applications could be huge. I mean, just muscle-wasting diseases and the elderly immediately come to mind. What a boon it would be for people like that. And hopefully, if this is proved to be safe and effective, I mean, how awesome would that be to quickly and easily, you know, put on 10 or 20 pounds of muscle? Although it's important to say that exercise, normal exercise, everything, the cardiovascular and weightlifting, have a lot more benefits than just in just a few, like muscle growth and other things. There's pages and pages of benefits. So replacing it with something like a pill, I think, would be very difficult. Another one, and we might see in a few years, is EPO, which is already available now. I believe it's pronounced erythropoietin.
Erythropoietin.
It's really big now. It's a hormone that basically boosts red blood cell production. The more red blood cells you have, the more oxygen mm-hmm. your muscles get, the better you perform. Clinical trials, though, are underway for a pill version of this instead of an injection. Now, apparently, this makes it not only easier to take but harder to detect. Some people think that these so-called HIF stabilizers, as they're called, are already being taken by athletes, and it's not known what some of the side effects might be, but people might already be taking this.
Just make one point here, Bob. That's a big concern with a lot of this. You know, the athletes are really early adopters of this new medical technology, because they want to get the edge over other ones before we really had the time to figure out what all the health risks of these kind of things are. For example, with myostatin, there's already evidence that that serves a useful role in muscle injury, that it also is important for making muscle tendons thicker and more flexible. So if you block myostatin, tendons tend to become shorter and more brittle. And you combine that with a stronger muscle, and that's a setup for injury. There may also be a tendency to be more susceptible to muscle injury itself with myostatin. So these things are not necessarily risk-free. They have to be researched in terms of its net effects. But athletes don't want to wait for all the careful research.
Oh,
they
no.
want to early adopt before their competitors do.
You could almost bet when you read articles about these huge fitness breakthroughs, the scientists invariably will say, yeah, half my emails now are from athletes asking if they can get this and or go on the trials and stuff. They just jump on this stuff. And this is one more here that's really interesting. Actually, I don't think it was even mentioned in the Wired magazine, but if you remember the past few months, there all this talk about the exercise pill, and this actually looks like a huge breakthrough. These scientists have developed drugs that actually mimic some of the effects of exercise in mice. One of them increased the running time by 44% in completely sedentary mice. These were couched potato mice, and bam, they're on this for a little while, and they're like athletes. Another one, this one was even more interesting. This one produced 77% greater endurance and the ability to run 66% further when you combine this drug with exercise. So if you exercise and take this drug, and the benefits are much better than compared to mice that just plain old exercise. So that one is really interesting. And I like that because, you know, at least you're still exercising and getting the other benefits of exercise.
The exercise pill claims were criticized a little bit because the researchers, you know, focused on only a couple of outcome measures, like their speed and endurance, and didn't. There's many, many physiological effects of exercise that they didn't even measure. So they're a long way from showing that this pill mimics the effects of exercise. You know, it could have just been, you know, boosting muscle activity temporarily and producing those research results. So that's way too preliminary to really start talking about what role that would play, if any, in promoting or maintaining, you know, health or activity. Certainly, they're a long way from showing that it's any kind of substitute for exercise.
Yeah, but it is still fascinating.
Steve, why do people on steroids lose muscle mass quickly once they go off the steroid?
Because the steroids are shifting their body metabolically into a state where they're burning fat and building muscle, and when you that suppresses your own body's ability to make those same hormones, those same steroids, and then when you go off of it, it takes your body time to recover and start making its own hormones again. And in the meantime, you're going to shift metabolically back the other way, where you're going to burn muscle and deposit fat. So it's just a withdrawal, from those artificially pushing the system in that one direction by taking exogenous steroids. It's not a healthy thing to do. It's generally not a good idea. Well, thanks, Bob. I'm also going to do a special report because I was asked by James Randi to help in a preliminary investigation for the James Randi $1 Million Psychic Challenge. My involvement was purely over email, but that's the stage that we were in the investigation. And now we've gotten a response from the claimant, and Randi gave me the green light to talk about this. It's an interesting story. The claimant is a man by the name of Colin Ross. His first contact with Randi, he said that he could make his computer make a noise with the power of his mind. Part of what's interesting about the whole process is that just trying to figure out what people are actually claiming, that's like 90%. Of the investigation is just trying to get the specific details about what they're actually claiming that they can do. Also, just going through the process of speculating about what could be really going on. So at this stage, Randi and I had a conversation about it, and with such little information, the possibilities were huge. So from we speculated that perhaps that he's being duped. Maybe someone who's working with him is making the computer make a noise remotely somehow and convincing him that he can do it, with his own power. Or I thought early on that, well, maybe it's a random event and it's all just pure confirmation bias, and there are various methods by which people can make themselves think that there's a correlation when there isn't one. Early, ESP researchers fell victim to all of these. So, for example, using loose criteria for a hit. Well, it always happens when I want it to happen, except when it doesn't. Or maybe it happens a few seconds before or a few seconds afterwards. It might take a few seconds for my power to work, but it always works eventually. So there's optional starting and stopping, loose criteria. So I figured, chances are, of course, this guy could always be consciously trying to hoax Randi, but if he's not a conscious hoaxer, that's usually what we find is the case. They're just deceiving themselves by using shoddy statistical or research methods. I likened it to somebody who claimed that they can make elevators arrive when they want them to. But
that's an awesome power.
But it may take a few seconds to work, though, So the outcome is no different than for anybody else, but if you just think you could make elevators come quicker and then you just use sort of subjective validation to reinforce that belief, you can convince yourself that you have some real power.
See, I can slow down the elevators. Yeah, I go in and I push every button.
I can get the elevator to stop at the 13th floor. It's just a special power I have.
That's a very special power.
Yeah.
So obviously we needed more information from this guy. Randi asked him to give us more details about exactly what he could do. That was just too vague. And he gave us more details and also sent us a link to a video. Some stupid local news outlet did a bit on him. And This is the, what the video shows and what he describes that he's doing. He's saying he could make a beam of energy come out of his eye and activate his computer to have it make a noise. A beam of energy. Awesome. This guy's friggin' Cyclops.
A beam. Does it make a noise? Does it go?
Well, it makes the computer make a noise.
Oh, the beam. I'm wondering the beam.
I can shoot lasers from my eye and my ass.
So we watched the video. In the video, he puts on these goggles, and and you can't see his eyes through the goggles. And on in front of one eye is like aluminum foil covering the goggle.
It's always tinfoil, isn't it? It always comes down to tinfoil.
Literally, there's tinfoil. It has to be tinfoil. And then there's an electrode attached to the aluminum foil. He attaches a second electrode to his right earlobe, a third electrode to his left earlobe. They all go into a box, some kind of digital converter, and then that plugs into his computer. And then he says, now when I'm going to make the beam come out of my eye and activate the electrode, and I'll signal that by raising my finger. And then, you know, he raises his finger and the computer goes bloop, 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 you know, and then he does that a couple of times. One time it happened a couple seconds after he raised his finger. And then when he was taking the equipment off, it went off again. But it was a pretty good correlation to his, you know, raising his finger. We revised our hypotheses based upon this new evidence. I was certainly very curious as to what all the electrodes were. I mean, he's claiming that he's shooting a beam out of his eye, but the bottom line was he was connected by electrodes to the computer. And Randy had sent this email to a bunch of people like Richard Wiseman and Phil Plait and others, since we were all kind of speculating that he has some software running on the computer that's making this noise. Maybe he knows what the intervals are, and he's just, you know, timing the intervals, and he gets it roughly correct. Maybe it's random, and he's again doing the confirmation bias, but he knows roughly what the time interval is on average, so he can guess pretty well just from experience. Or maybe those electrodes are triggering something. So he said, well, what is the software you're running, and what's that box you're attaching those electrodes to? And I speculated even at this point that's all we knew. I said, perhaps he's, you know, using EEG signals to activate those electrodes. I said, you know, you can activate it not only just from your brainwave activity, but also from muscle activity, and even moving your eyes can activate the electrodes. So then he tells us, and I think this guy's a sincere kook, is the bottom line. By the way, he basically answered our questions when we pushed him for more details. He's told us that what that equipment is, it's biofeedback equipment. It's designed to measure brain waves and then to create a sound when it detects certain brainwave frequencies, and it's a biofeedback device to try to train you or teach you how to get your brain within a certain wavelength, like to create alpha waves or whatever. You know, it's a little bit pseudoscientific in and of itself, but, you know, the whole using EEGs for biofeedback like that, but it could be, it's like semi-legitimate. But anyway, that's irrelevant to how he was using it. So I'm like, you mean to tell me this guy has an EEG attached to his head and he's using software that's designed to detect EEG waves and make a noise? And he has a beam coming out of his eye to explain that? So,
Work without the beam, doctor.
What's the disconnect here? Why does this guy think he needs to have a beam coming out of his eye when he has an EEG electrode attached to his head?
He's physically attached to the damn thing.
Steve, settle down a little.
No, I mean, it was really amazing. Like, what's going on in this guy's head? So I said, all right, so I refined my hypothesis further still. And I said, because, you know, I'm trained in clinical neurophysiology, so I actually know how EEGs work. Right. So this guy actually was able to set the filter settings too. So you have to keep in mind, he was able to set the parameters for what would set off the machine. So he set it to whatever set off the machine. You know, he set the filters in such a way that he could make it go off. But I figured out that, you know, we can't see his eyes. What this guy's doing is he's just blinking his eyes.
Mm.
Now, what he may not have known is that your eye is a dipole. Your retina is negative and your cornea is positive. Okay. So it's like a little dipole. And when you close your eyes, they normally will turn up inside your head. that's called the Bell's phenomenon. You could actually see it if someone has facial weakness like a Bell's palsy. You could see their eye roll up. But it happens to everybody when you close your eyes. So that little dipole flips up when you close your eye and then flips back down when you open your eye. So if you blink your eyes, it sort of flips up and down. And there's an eye-opening artifact that's a very big artifact on EEG. It's basically a big EEG wave. And there's an eye-closing artifact. And you can see them very, very clearly on an EEG. And he had an electrode in front of his eye. You know, I think the tinfoil, which he said was necessary to keep out extraneous, you know, EM energy. I think it was also acting like a little bit of a dish to amplify the signals from his eye. But even without that, I mean, the ear electrodes would pick it up too. I mean, they're close enough where they could pick up eye-opening artifact, especially depending on the sensitivity he had the whole thing set to. So he was just opening his eye and setting off the machine. That's
so why
it.
Why the goggles, though?
Well, because he thinks that he has an energy beam coming out of his eye. And he
needed protecting people from, like, dying from this energy beam?
Well, it's not that strong. But, I mean, he needed to keep out other energy so that the eye beam can be detected. So this guy had himself convinced that he was shooting a beam of energy out of his eye when it was just a known EEG effect of just the eye rolling back up when you close your eyes.
See, I knew the tinfoil was a giveaway here as far as what we were dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, this is partly why. I mean, I had fun doing this whole thing. It was kind of like a little, you know, things are always mini mysteries. And we definitely shut this guy down, you know, pretty quick.
So how'd you let him down, Steve?
Randy was communicating directly with him. I was just communicating with Randy. So I told Randy this. I said, listen, this is obviously an eye-opening artifact. I mean, that's all the pieces are there. It's clearly what's happening. So Randy sent this to the guy. And now just yesterday, Colin Ross sent his latest reply to Randy. He writes, "Dear James Randy, after doing further testing, I have satisfied myself concerning 2 points. One, there is definitely an EM beam emerging from the eyes that has higher amplitude and distinct electrophysiologic properties compared to the field emerging through the forehead. And two, the tone in my neurofeedback system is being triggered by eye blink artifact, not by the EEG signal."
Aren't those two things like counterintuitive? I mean,
yeah,
aren't they like?
Yeah, isn't one redundant if you accept two? If you accept that all of the evidence you were putting forward for the eye beam is the eye blink? So he basically tested out my idea and figured, oh my God, it is happening when I blink my eyes.
He's like,
and he says, I need to do more work on modifying my system to eliminate movement artifact before I can do the preliminary test. This will most likely require a higher impedance electrode and may take a few weeks or a few months. I will get back to you in that time frame. My goal is to set up a system where artifact can be ruled out to our joint satisfaction. Thanks. So Randy's response to that, to us, not to him, was, all right, we're never going to see this guy again. You know, once he gets to the, let me fix my system and I'll be back in a few months, I mean, he never hears from people again. That's always their graceful exit from the testing procedure.
Let me scrape together a few bucks and I'll fix this thing up in a second. Thanks.
Just have to tweak the gizmotron.
I've come to a conclusion, A and not A.
Not A.
It's definitely A, but not because of A.
A, my original claim is still true, but B, you were right, and it was all an artifact. Okay.
But I need to do some more work on modifying my system.
So I think what this guy was doing was that he had himself convinced that he was building up this energy inside his head, then he was shooting it out his eyes, but he had to, he would open his eyes at the moment the energy was shooting out, but that was creating the signal. The opening of the eyes was creating the signal that was setting off his detection equipment, you know, his EEG biofeedback equipment. So anyway, obviously it's silly, but it does illustrate why the scientific method is what it is, why we have things like peer review, you know. It's people who have an assortment of expertise. Like for me, I knew instantly that this was eye-opening artifact because I've studied EEGs, you know, that this guy couldn't figure it out and that he, you know, leapt to this new phenomenon of shooting EM beams out of his eyes because he didn't know that there was eye-opening artifact, you know.
But still, all right, fine. It shouldn't be immediately obvious to anyone but maybe a neurologist or someone who's uses equipment. But you would think he'd throw a few tests in there to disprove his hypothesis. Like aim at a barrier. Put a barrier up so that there's no way your beam can bore through it to get to the detector, and it would still go off, and then you'd have to think, well, wait a second, maybe it's not a beam coming out of my eye, maybe it's something else. You know, wouldn't that be a normal test that you might want to consider doing just to rule it out, to somehow disprove
Bob.
It? You don't have to be an expert in EEGs to rule that out.
You're right. What you're doing is just taking what any scientist would do. They would try to control as many variables. They would try to disprove their hypothesis by doing exactly what you're saying. So if my hypothesis is true, if I'm shooting a beam out of my eye, then let me do this the same thing except not try to shoot a beam out of my eye and see if I still get the signal. Let me do everything that I'm doing, opening and closing my eyes and electrodes hooked up the same way. Or your test is also another one. If this is a beam, let me try to block the beam and see if that stops the signal. Whatever. You think of all different ways you can test the hypothesis to try to prove it wrong. And only if it survives all of those tests would you then, you know, have the press release, go on the news channel and submit, you know, for the $1 million psychic challenge, you know? But he's kind of skipped over those steps that we call legitimate science. Well, let's go on with our interview. We are sitting here now with Adam Savage of the Mythbusters. Adam, welcome back to the Skeptics Guide.
Thank you very much.
We had the pleasure of interviewing you at last year's TAM, and we were very excited to hear that you were going to be here again, and we have another opportunity to sit and talk with you. So how are you enjoying the conference so far?
Yeah, very much. And this is absolutely my kind of crowd.
It's good to hear.
Cool.
Great. Yeah. Everybody is incredibly friendly and generous, and it's, you know, it's a mixed blessing sometimes being famous and having people come up to you all the time, but it's not at a place like this. Mm-hmm. At a place like this, making myself available and just keep continuing to foment exactly what people say they like about the show, which is the accessibility and how much they identify with Jamie and I. It's a real pleasure to do that, and people have been coming up to me. This is my third TAM, and people are coming up to me this year and saying that, you know, meeting me last year was really great, and they've been talking about it all year, and they came back to meet me again, and that's thrilling. That's fantastic.
Awesome. You find you get good feedback for just your show from meeting your fans at places like this?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Of course, we get a lot of emails from people telling us that we screwed things up.
Mm-hmm. Really, we never get those.
Yeah, never.
And I am absolutely positive that that if I took an informal survey when I got up on stage, that probably half of the audience here at TAM has at one point or another yelled at me or Jamie at the television for being freaking idiots. And yet, all of that goes out the window when they come up and say hello. There's nothing but goodwill, because I think they see the real intellectual honesty in even our screw-ups, that we're never trying to put anything over, and there's never going to be a man versus wild moment with us, which is, you know, Discovery was right to say that was a problem with marketing more than the show. The show is just edited without the transparency that people have come to expect from, quote, reality mm-hmm. television. Mm-hmm. And that kind of transparency, which we work really rigorously to bring to the show, I think surpasses any times when people think, oh my God, I can't believe they don't realize that tracer rounds aren't what they're using.
Do you find that hard, that transparency? Because the process is so artificial, in that you're filming things probably out of sequence sometimes and splicing it all together, and just the final product is such a small piece of all the filming that you do. I'm assuming that's just the way it's usually done. That how do you keep that transparent when the process is so artificial?
That's a great question. One of the ways we do that is that Jamie and I are absolutely a key part of how every story gets told. Mm-hmm. There's nothing written down for us. There's nothing wrote. We do the intros and outros to the shows in what's called the blueprint room. We do that last, usually at the end of every episode. And those are the links that we, you know, link between sequences. We don't know what those sequences will be until we try things. Mm-hmm. That's another way we maintain the transparency. Yeah. We start with a rough shooting script, how we think the experiment's going to go, but it rarely goes the way we think mm-hmm. it's going to go. And we are constantly changing parameters based on, wow, I didn't realize that was going to be so difficult. Now we're going to need an extra day on location, or now we're going to need a different location. And that means that even though we might shoot some things out of order, usually it's painfully obvious demonstrations mm-hmm. that will shoot out of order.
Right.
The fact is we're involved in the whole process.
Yeah.
So there is really a process. There really is a discovery happening on that day that we're firing things into ballistics gel or, you know, setting up our cannon.
Isn't it funny, though, you have to actually say that? Because so much of what we digest is fake, completely fake. I mean, even all the reality, they call them reality TV shows. you know, really, like, what you do is an actual reality TV show.
You know, again, I'd say that it's a fuzzy line. We do several takes of everything for different camera angles. For key discussions, we'll shoot a wide and cut in for inserts and do that. Jamie and I have, for better or worse, Jamie specifically, I mean, I have 5 years of acting training, but Jamie's gotten very good at appearing much more natural and much more genuine on camera, much to his chagrin. And see, the other thing is that because we're so involved in the process, we really know that we're telling a story. And there's a reality to the story that doesn't necessarily mean that it's cameras falling around getting 8 hours of footage per camera per day. Actually, our shooting ratio has gone way down because we've gotten much more efficient at telling the story than we used to be. Used to be they would have 40 hours of footage to cut 40 minutes.
Wow.
Now it's more like 20, 25 hours of footage.
Oh, that's great.
But, you know, we are in that story is a real story. And even though we might know how certain experiments are going to turn out, it's still a story we're totally interested in.
Yeah.
It's still something we were trying to demonstrate electricity's transfer through water recently. And in his classic style, Jamie was like, well, I'll just get a water pistol and we'll put some electricity behind it and we'll measure when it gets to, you know, we'll put an oscilloscope on the ground and measure when it gets there. And, of course, there's so much turbulence in the water, the signal is completely – it's impossible both to get a solid signal and because Jamie's holding this big water pistol, the distance is varying greatly.
Mm-hmm.
And it – you know, I say this at the beginning, like, I don't think this experiment's going to work very well because of all these variables. Jamie's like, well, I just want to try it. And he'll go and do it. And then after watching him flail for 3 hours, which is exactly what happened, I said
– Told you so.
No, I didn't. I said, you know what, but also realizing actually that this was a terrific example of how to boil out variables.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I said, well, look, what's our stream? Would you agree with me it's about 3/16? Okay, let's get some 3/16 clear ID tubing. Let's stick it in the ballistics gelatin at the source, and let's put electrodes in, first 2 inches away, then 1 foot, then 2 feet, then 3 feet. And then we did that, and the ballistics gelatin was giving us some funny readings, so we went out and got a leg of lamb, jammed it in a leg of lamb, got much, and all of a sudden, after like 4 separate attempts at this experiment, we had boiled away enough parameters to get a set of readings which actually were linear in their deterioration, which is, that's what we were looking for.
I just love the phrase, so we went out and got a leg of lamb. That's how you know you've got a great show on your hands, I think.
So have you ever had a total failure of a show? Like, I wouldn't know how to describe it, but anything?
Nothing usable, nothing?
Yeah.
That's a good question. We've had stuff where locations kicked our ass. Train suction, the idea of, it's very hard to phrase this. If you're standing on a train platform and the train goes by, it'll suck you off.
Yeah.
It'll do what? I'm sorry.
And it was very difficult to find anybody with a bona fide train platform that would let us use it with a real train.
Yeah.
Let us try this. That took actually a year and a half to achieve. As far as an experiment where things just went really south, you know, I know there's probably been something where we filmed a bunch of stuff and it just never quite gelled into something and we had to abandon it. But it's usually within the first day of experimentation we realized that this actually isn't a story.
Yep.
And I don't think it's happened more than once or twice.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you show the process and not just the end result and pretend like that's what we were going for all along. But you kind of show that, this kind of evolved over time.
Well, and actually it's the thing that's most satisfying is, you know, we're not going to stand by our results.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have data sets of one and less than one sometimes.
Yeah.
And there's nobody that's emailed us and thanked us for the groundbreaking work in urban legend research we've been doing.
Yes, right.
But working scientists from every organization you can imagine have written to us and said, you're showing the scientific method for what it is, which is messy and confusing deeply
exactly
creative.
Right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. That's
absolutely.
Right.
And that's an interesting point that I wanted to hit. We've been interviewing a lot of bloggers and podcasters, and a recurring theme has been interaction with the audience, and I think you guys seem to do a really great job of it. How much do you think that your interaction with your audience has contributed to the show's success?
Well, it works on so many levels. It works on a level of the fact that for some reason, both Jamie and I, through two totally different paths, don't mind being ourselves on camera.
Yeah.
But I, for one, when I'm doing a piece to camera, I very specifically think about my toughest audience, which is my wife. And I'll tell you, you know, I get home at the end of the day, and she really doesn't want to hear about the great time I had shooting things at the shooting range every single day. But if I really did have a particularly excellent experience with solving some problem, that's who I think about when I'm doing a piece to camera, because she's the toughest audience, and what she's interested in is not what I was doing, not even the parameters of what I was doing. She's interested in how thrilled I was by doing it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so that interaction I'm having with the camera, which is very specifically when I'm trying to achieve some kind of real transparency to my thought process and my emotional process about doing this show, I recognize as key to people's involvement in what we're doing.
Yeah.
It makes them realize that, you know, they're not just watching someone tell them how things are supposed to turn out. Because, I mean, I've seen, but when we did the elevator, should you jump up just before the elevator falls?
Mm-hmm.
I had seen four or five different science shows attempting to show why it wouldn't help, including Bill Nye.
I was about to say, I saw it on Bill Nye ages ago. Yeah.
I love Bill Nye, but honestly, I didn't understand what was going on from watching his demonstration.
Didn't he use like an egg?
Yeah, he used an egg. And again, he didn't have a high-speed camera to show that the egg was jumping up at the last second.
It just sort of like flicked and yolk and that's your head. Yeah,
precisely. and, you know, for us, getting a 10-story crack hotel turned out to be the magic bullet.
Nice. And then, you know, so then you've got that interaction for you with the camera seems to result in your audience wanting to email you, and you've got message boards and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And haven't you been picking up more ideas for the show from your fans?
It's the stuff we get personally in Jamie's and my email, and stuff that's posted to the Discovery boards has always been a really key part. More than ever before, Jamie and I are real drivers in the material that we shoot. There is really a quartet of brain trust at the center of Mythbusters. And it's Jamie and I, Dan Tapster, our executive producer in Australia, and Alice Dallow, our director producer on the ground in San Francisco. And between the four of us, we're the ones that decide exactly what to do. Dan has people monitor the Discovery boards. I don't read the Discovery fan boards. I don't read the Slashdot comments. I don't read the Reddit comments. They've actually really screwed me up from time to time.
Really?
They're so vitriolic. It's like, you know, you've ever had your day ruined by just someone next to you in a car, not even railing at you, but having road rage. Like, it's so disturbing to see someone so upset.
Yeah. Mm.
And you read those things and people get... And you know that it's like some 15-year-old kid.
The internet is filled with 15-year-old kids.
Yeah. And I liken them all to people in their cars. They're at the computer, which is just like being in your car, your armored car, so you can give the finger to anybody you want, and there's no repercussions because you're going to be gone.
Computer rage.
Yeah.
Right. Computer rage, that's right.
Keyboard cowboys, I call them.
Yeah. I actually got an email back, because I love responding and just demolishing them. And then I got an email back once, like, oh, I thought this was just going to evaporate in the ether when I hit the send button. My email. No, there's a person at the other end of the email. You know, but you're right. So you're cocooned in your little world. So you think that it's not reality out there that you're emailing to.
So every now and then I get some from last year's TAM on my Wikipedia page. Which, by the way, I think Wikipedia needs an edit for the subject of the Wikipedia page. It needs a special edit tag. Like, I should be able to go onto my Wikipedia page and correct factual errors. And then that edit should have my tag on it, right? Mm-hmm. Like a colored asterisk that says the subject of this Wikipedia page has made this alteration.
That's a good idea.
Because on Wikipedia, they think my middle name is John, which it isn't.
What's your middle name?
Whitney.
Whitney.
It's a family name.
It's a family
name. It's actually my father's first name.
There you go.
I'd stick with John.
At any rate, every now and then I do end up responding to some email that I shouldn't.
Yeah.
And I got one a couple of months ago where some guy said, "You guys really..." And there's always this kind of really lazy arrogance. You guys make me laugh. Sometimes the stuff you do is pretty smart, but I could prove I could prove that evolution is bunk and creationism in 5 minutes with you.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and I had just gotten home. I was a little tipsy,
and
I drunk dialed. I was like, "How nice for you, send." Yeah.
Have you ever typed out a whole email and then before you hit send, delete?
Yeah, of course.
Well, I did have a military guy write to me and was quite insulting about something he said. Oh no, it was the tracer rounds thing where he said, "You guys are freaking idiots for the tracer rounds you used." And I wrote back and said, "Actually, you know when." Our experts, our ballistics experts for the State Police of California and the FBI, I'm going to trust the material they bring to us. I recognize that we may not have had a complete sample, but I'm going to trust the material that they bring to us. And in my where I come from, we start our email with a salutation and we sign it with our fucking name. And he, and that was, again, I had two drinks in me and I was pissed off. And he ended up writing back a fantastic letter saying, I am very sorry for my rudeness. And he said, here's the information you didn't have. And it was fantastic.
But why wouldn't they start like that? And the answer is, and I think it just has to do with personal ego. Everybody likes to, oh, that guy's on TV, he's famous, or that guy's on the radio.
Or they wanted to get his attention first, right?
I don't think it's that conscious. I just think, social things are gone, right? There's no social structure there. It's just it's email.
Punctuation's gone. Capitalization.
And so, yet, despite all that vitriol, you know, you still come out to things like TAM. I mean, I remember meeting you at TAM 4, and I got to ride in the limo with you, which was like, I was so thrilled.
How nice
beyond belief. But your enthusiasm, you guys were wiped out. You had been traveling all day, but you were so like, this is the coolest thing ever. I'm coming back every year. And I think that, like, we feel that, you know, that love. And it's just so fantastic that you...
Honestly, remember that my job on a day-to-day basis is me, Jamie, camera, sound, and a producer, director. It's five of us. It's dirty. It's hard work. It's confusing. And it's very blue-collar. I go home filthy and tired. And yet, what we do ends up being seen in 140 countries in 9 languages, 120 hours of programming we've produced so far.
And do you watch yourself in German just to see what you sound like in German?
I haven't seen myself in German. Actually, I was in Montreal 2 weeks ago. I was there during the Grand Prix, and this guy came up to me in a restaurant, so random, and he said, in broken English, with his friend as a translator, I do your voice for the Spanish language.
Oh my God.
Mythbusters. And the fact is that's his voice is everything from Mexico to the southern tip of South America and Spain.
Mm-hmm.
It's
fantastic.
All across the world, this guy's voice. And he's very well, I know, because we did a Listerine commercial in Spanish.
You did?
And this guy, they hired this guy to do my voice and his partner to do Jamie's voice. And they were very excited to get the actual
voice. Have like a really high squeaky voice?
He sounds like Marcello Mastroianni.
But a sexy Latin voice.
So to me, the idea that very specifically people who are coming to a conference about critical thinking are thrilled about the show that we're doing, mm-hmm. that these stories that we work hard to tell and, you know, we take real pride in trying to tell truthfully have this kind of effect is, like I said, I don't sense anything out in the world but real goodwill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So how long do you see the show going on, and do you see like the format changing in any way or...
Well, the format's evolved over the years. We've gone into lots of different areas, from product testing to idioms. Idiomatic phrases have provided hours of stuff. We've delved, as the budget's gotten bigger, a lot more into movie myths and television myths, MacGyver, James Bond, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Jaws.
Awesome. And you know we're doing Shark Week again this year.
Are you?
Yeah, we were down in the Bahamas in March, and 3 hours of shark programming coming up in late July.
Oh, boy.
Oh, can't wait.
Wow. Yeah.
What was the Pirates of the Caribbean stuff?
We did several pirate specials. Pirate specials turned out to be really popular.
Figure, pirates. I mean,
they're very really popular.
I really tried to do pirates versus ninjas. I really tried to see a way to narratively do it that wasn't absolutely stupid, and I could not come up with one.
No, you need to do a whole show. Who would win in a fight? Pirate versus ninjas, shark versus bear. You know
exactly. But we did. It's absolutely ridiculous, but people loved it. We did the, could you really turn a rowboat upside down and walk on the bottom with it while, like, breathing from it?
Oh, yeah.
Which actually turned out to be quite a dangerous and difficult thing to do, because in order to have a boat full of air underwater, you've got to put a shitload of weight on it.
Oh, yeah, that's hard.
And to do that in a safe fashion when you can't actually speak to each other. And this was actually a really lovely moment. I mean, Jamie and I, like we've always said, it's really true. We're not friends. We don't hang out. We don't even particularly like each other. But we have a partnership based on a deep amount of trust and respect. And we often will, finish each other's sentences. In fact, a lot of times we'll be having a conversation and they'll say, could you please do that conversation again with pronouns this time? Because I didn't get anything. And we were down under the water, and we've got this boat, and it's moving in very unpredictable ways, and we're trying to make it predictable, and we're on sawhorses we built at the bottom of a pool we can't mark with, like, 1,200 pounds of weight on it, and trying to fill it with air. And, you know, there's 4 other crew members underwater, including us, and Jamie and I, they're all trusting us to keep them safe, and Jamie and I are doing you know, this, we're making up a sign language,
the
and there's absolutely hand signals, hand gestures.
We're like in it for all, like, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
We all nod at our heads.
Yes. Yeah. You can subtitle it.
Yeah, great.
There you go. So we're doing all these hand signals to each other, and they're not causing any more delay than talking to us underwater, just because we, in the key moments, really do think exactly alike about how things are working and how they ought to work.
Yeah.
So I see the show. I don't see any end to this. I mean, obviously there will be some kind of natural.
Well, one day you're going to die. That's why you're.
Yeah, hopefully it's not on the show.
How long is your current contract for?
Discovery has me and Jamie out until the next season. We're just started shooting series 6. They have us until the end of series 7, which carries us to filming until the end of 2010. Which means the show will be airing until the beginning of 2011.
Wow.
And then, honestly, we've got enough material to carry us out through then, and we're always about 60 or 70 minutes ahead of the curve. There's entire hour-long special. I've got 3 or 4 entire hour-long specials that, you know, still to do. High fidelity, still got to do vinyl versus CD.
Yep. Right. Yeah.
Still got to do speaker cable versus coat hanger.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ah.
Awesome. And, you know, last year, I think it was, you were working on quantifying the differences between things like an ass load and a shit load.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. How's that going?
My taxonomy of nonsense words for large and small numbers. It's still in the works. I met a lovely man here, a friend of Jamie and Swiss's, Chip Denham.
Yeah.
He's a statistician. He's mm-hmm. wonderful. He actually consulted with us very recently because next week when I get back, we're going to be doing beer goggles.
Oh, God.
Beer goggles.
Beer goggles. So women get more attractive the more you drink. Or men, because Carrie and Jamie and I will all be getting drunk and reviewing photos. And in terms of quantifying a statistical difference between the photos that we monitor when we're sober and when we're drunk, it took a little figuring to get the methodology right.
Yep.
And in the end, Chip helped out and confirmed that the way we were thinking about it was actually right. So what I'd still like to do is there's plans for an Adam and Jamie website. Mm-hmm. In the works. Actually, we have some fairly big plans that I can't mention, but one of them is a website, and on that website, I definitely would like to do the survey in a digital form, kind of the way Flickr does, but choose the best image. They give you 2 images, you choose the best one. Give you 2 words from a category, choose what you think is the biggest. It's a self-selected group, to be sure. But, you know, after 4,000 or 5,000, after 4,000 or 5,000 entries, I figure I could actually publish a pretty reasonable white paper.
Well, you know, that's how Richard Wiseman did the World's Funniest Joke survey. So you should talk to him. He'd probably help you out.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Excellent.
So you don't have your eyes on the next project. You're content just doing what you're doing and expanding your current...
Not at all. I always have my eyes on the next project. As a freelancer for 10 years, 15 years before I did Mythbusters, I'm always wondering what's next. You're always thinking, you know, do I stay in this or do I mean, at one point I even looked into being a magic illusion designer. Mm-hmm. Except I realized I'd probably have to move to LA or Vegas to do it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, so I kept on special effects. But so I'm thinking all sorts of different things. I have several show ideas. There's a lot of consulting that I'd like to be doing for other shows. There's a lot of networks out there that want to figure out what the formula behind Mythbusters' success is, and I think I actually know what that formula is, and I'd like to help other people make programs that are similar in terms of their honesty, their intellectual honesty, and their interest level.
Well, then you should talk to Ryan Johnson, the producer of The Skeptologist.
Yeah. I give a lot of time to people who've got questions about that kind of stuff. I also look forward to teaching, honestly. I taught advanced model making at the Academy of Art College in San Francisco, which was basically walking around putting out fires and giving kids better solutions.
Literally,
and so much fun. Mm-hmm. I really look forward to teaching on a university level, advanced problem solving 101. Jamie wants to teach a course called Not Fucking Around 101, which is basically just like get simpler, make it simpler, make it even simpler than that, get even simpler than that.
That's
breaking
great.
Things down to there.
Right. I have a random question.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you like South Park?
I do like South Park. I don't watch a lot of television regularly. My wife and I make time, I think, 3 times per season to catch up with Lost.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. We'll have marathons.
Yeah.
The shows I watch are things like The Closer, which I love. Strangely, and this is going to be really weird, and everyone listening to this is going to go, and clutch their pearls, but I love Medium. And I'll tell you why I love Medium. I love Medium for their home life. I don't care much for the plots, and I find the plots actually disgusting and kind of disturbing. But I don't know another show that shows just a sweetly loving married couple with kids in a better light. It's chaotic and confusing and messy, and I really love watching their marriage go.
Yeah, you see, I can't get past the title.
Yeah, that's where I lose. No, I totally realize that there's no reason you should get past the title.
I need to put this on Twitter right now.
Newsflash.
Ad is heaven. Loves Medium.
I really dig Lost.
Yeah, I love it.
It's
too.
Fun. It's a definitely fun. Fun show. It sucks you in.
Yeah.
Have you been parodied yet on any like Simpsons or anything?
We were parodied on the MTV show on something. No, Comedy Central. Some program on Comedy Central parodied Jamie and I investigating whether masturbation makes you go blind.
it's
all in claymation.
Hey, Steve, you don't have to ask that question. Every man on earth knows the answer is no.
Yeah, exactly.
Blind guys aren't too sure,
yeah, right? Through a sample size of N equaling the entire male population of the world. What is the sample size of all? Yeah. And I know that we've been parodied in many different countries on different, like in South America, there is actually a recurring Mythbusters parody of these two guys that don't look anything like us. They do some very funny stuff.
Yeah.
The one I saw was they had a guy from the audience sit in a chair and they covered him with a blanket and then they buried a samurai sword in his head. It was clear that all they'd done is as they were putting the blanket on, they just put a watermelon on top of his head, you know, on a helmet, and they just right through it. I will tell you that Mythbusters has been on kind of a hiatus on the network for the last few months. They are planning a big push of 3 months' worth of all new episodes starting in August, right after the 3 hours of Shark Week, Mythbusters Shark Week 08 airs.
Excellent. Cool.
And that looking starts, that. I think it kicks off in the beginning of August with the NASA moon landing special.
Oh,
great.
Yeah. There's a ton of really great stuff
that
there.
That sounds really good. Well, Adam, this is a pleasure as always.
Thank
really
you
appreciate
so
you sitting with us.
Pleasure
Thank
for me,
again.
Too.
Thanks,
I'll
Adam.
Talk to you guys next year.
All right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We do have a theme this week.
Ooh,
the theme this week is material science. All about new materials. Ready? Number one, by making an alloy of iron, silicon, and manganese, researchers have created a practical superconductor at temperatures just under 0 degrees Celsius, just short of the holy grail of a quote-unquote room-temperature superconductor. Item number two, a new study shows that lining endotracheal tubes used for patients on a ventilator with silver reduces the incidence of pneumonia by 36%. And item number three, scientists have developed a thin film that can radically change its absorption or emittance of light and heat, which can be used to insulate so-called microsatellites. Evan, go first.
Okay, an alloy of iron, silicon, and manganese, a practical superconductor at temperatures just under 0 degrees Celsius. That sounds incredibly plausible, so I'm suspect. Next, lining the endotracheal tubes used for patients on a ventilator with silver reduces incidence of pneumonia by 36%. So who... wonder why. I wonder why they would think to maybe even use silver. The last one, thin film radically changing the absorption or emittance of light and heat, which can be used to insulate so-called microsatellites. I don't know what I can infer what a microsatellite is. I know nothing of it.
So a microsatellite's a satellite less than 50 pounds.
Ah, thank you. They all sound plausible. I think number two sounds the least plausible, but I'm not sure that that's the fiction. So I'll go with my gut, which tells me the room temperature superconductor with that new alloy, I think that one's fiction. I think it's a curveball.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Evan on that, definitely. That's the one of the three that I'm pretty sure I would have heard of, and I don't think we're there yet.
Okay, Bob?
The number two, the lining the endotracheal tubes with silver... I don't know, that sounds right to me. That sounds, I'm believing that one. Something about, I don't know, something about the silver maybe helping reduce the potential for bacterial or viral infections getting to the lung. I don't know, that just sounds right. Number three also sounds right about, I know they've been trying for a while to to make these micro satellites feasible, and there was some sort of micro satellite breakthrough recently, and I think that's why they're talking about it now, is because they had this breakthrough in the thin film. Number one, a superconductor at just below zero, which is what kind of a leap is that? 170 degree jump. The latest was, you know, around liquid nitrogen temperatures. So that's quite a leap. And I have to say, I would have heard of it, because that's such a huge, huge advance. I'm gonna have to say that one is fiction.
Okay, so you're all in agreement. So let's take these in reverse order this week. Scientists have developed a thin film that can radically change its absorption of and emittance of light and heat, which can be used to insulate so-called microsatellites. And that is science. This is a cool breakthrough. What they developed is this material. It's like a sandwich of materials, and it's extremely thin. With the application of electrical currents, they can basically change its color in the visible as well as UV and infrared spectrum, so that it could either, if it were in space, if it were in sunlight, it could reflect all the sunlight away so that it wouldn't heat up. And if it's in shadow, it could absorb what little, you know, radiation it does get, and then also would insulate it from loss of heat. So it's essentially just the ability to radically change its color, its light emittance, that makes it potentially gives it could be used for these very, very tiny satellites, which have a lot of, you know, the big problem is that they can't miniaturize the heating and cooling temperature regulation for these satellites. So this would be a way to do that. It's also very tough. So the coating would be effective at keeping out micrometeoroids. They tested the material, they say, by just shooting stuff at it, you know, shooting, you know, sharp, hard stuff at high velocity at it, to sort of simulate the micrometeoroids.
Yeah, EM beams, all kinds of stuff.
Right. And the goal of all this is to reduce the cost of getting pounds into space, right? If you could send up really tiny satellites, well, microsatellites are less than 50 pounds, and they also have nanosatellites, which are less than 10 pounds.
Whoa, nanosatellites, Bob.
Yeah. Nanosatellites. That's awesome.
Let's go on to the next item. A new study shows that lining endotracheal tubes used for patients on a ventilator with silver reduces the incidence of pneumonia by 36%. And that one is also science.
Woo-hoo.
And yeah, the idea is actually not that much of a stretch. I mean, it's known that silver has antimicrobial properties. It actually, you know, kills bacteria and other microbes and prevents them from adhering to the tube itself. So what they did is a study published recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and they used silver-coated endotracheal tubes and found that the incidence of ventilator-acquired pneumonia was reduced from 7.5% to 4.8%. That's significant. You know, that would significantly reduce morbidity and mortality, hospital stays. So it's a nice little advance. Which means that all of you guys are right, that number one, by making an alloy of iron, silicon, and manganese, researchers have created a practical superconductor at temperatures just under 0 degrees Celsius. Just
manganese.
Short of the holy grail of a room temperature superconductor is fiction.
Sounds like there's a kernel of truth in there.
And again, I had to think, you know, how high to go with the temperature to make it seem, be a clue. Bobby obviously honed in on that certainly would be a dramatic jump in. You know, unless it was something that was just in the news today, you probably would have heard about it. You know, I've had to make it fair without being ridiculous.
You should have made it like minus 90 degrees.
Well, yeah, of course. You know, once I know what the response is, I would, you know, tweak it later, you know. Hindsight's 20/20. But this is based on a real news story, which is actually pretty cool in its own right, because scientists did figure out how to make an alloy of silicon, iron, and manganese, all very, very common. Nothing uncommon about any of these elements. Obviously, iron, you know, silicon. Even manganese, which is just another metal, is very, very common. So iron is a ferromagnetic material, and silicon is a semiconductor. And these two materials are the backbone of our industry and technology for those two properties. And what they realize is that by combining them together – with a little bit of manganese, they create a material that is a kind of an, you see, like a quantum halfway state between being a magnet and a semiconductor. So it's like half of both, which could have a lot of interesting applications. Again, in computer technology, for example, anything that gives you control over the flow of electrons could potentially have a lot of applications, especially in computer technology. So, you know, this is a sort of a basic science materials advance, but some of these have incredible applications long term. It's hard to always imagine immediately what all the applications are going to be. Now it's a matter of just once you perfect the manufacturing process for different industries and people to try to figure out ways to use it. And you know, that's where things get interesting. But they said that Professor J.F. DeTusa of Louisiana State University, who co-authored the paper, said, "It's amazing that something which was thought to exist theoretically in mathematical physics could actually be found in an alloy which was simply formed by melting together a few common elements." Yeah, that's the thing that kind of struck me about this, too, is that, you know, it's just iron and silicon. It's not like it's really some very advanced technology that they used to make it.
And why wasn't it done already?
Yeah, you would think, why didn't this happen 50 years ago? You know,
well, something slipped through the cracks, you know? Just goes to show you there's still a lot out there to discover.
Yeah. That's why basic science is so important.
Can't wait till they combine hydrogen and oxygen someday.
see what comes of that.
Dihydrogen oxide? Big deal.
And Bob, I think you were pretty close. So the highest superconducting temperature we've achieved so far,
it's around liquid nitrogen. It's around that. Is that minus 170?
So 138 Kelvin, and that is a mercury, thallium, barium, calcium, copper oxide. But they claim that by applying pressure, they could get that up to 164 Kelvin, which is still about 109 below zero Celsius. So, yeah, this would have been an increase of about 100 degrees Celsius. Or
yeah, that's
pretty significant.
Yeah. Oh, man, yeah.
One day.
Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I indeed have a quote. This quote is from the 14th Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama, who is the revered spiritual leader of the Tibetans. And he actually is a pretty interesting guy. You should do a little reading on him. And he said, "To defy the authority of empirical evidence is to disqualify oneself as someone worthy of critical engagement in a dialogue." The 14th Dalai Lama!
You know what else he told me? He said, "When you die, you will achieve total consciousness."
Total consciousness.
Oh, I got
on
that
your
going
deathbed.
For me.
And that quote was sent in by a listener. His name is Robert Reppy.
So next weekend, we will be at DragonCon, Bob, Evan, and I. So again, if you can join us in Atlanta, Georgia, it should be a lot of fun. And we'll be recording a live show. Derek from Skepticality will be joining us, and Swoopy, if she has time. The two of them are basically running the event, so they're going to be extremely busy. But Derek at least said that he would have time to sit down with us as we record a live show. And we'll be giving lectures and, you know, meeting and greeting our listeners. So if you can, come and see us. All right, guys. Thanks for joining me again.
Our pleasure.
Steve. Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.